listener production.
Gutta Goldstein was 9 when her life changed forever. The Germans invaded Poland. It was World War II and the beginning of one of the most evil times in our world's history, the Holocaust. In August 1944, Gutta was moved to Auschwitz. Gutta recalls, as the skinny little girl with dark eyes, she looked 9 rather than her real age of 14. Girls this young were forbidden to still be alive. Flanked on either side by her older cousins Inka and Carmela, she had survived another selection for the gas chambers. Her cousin maintains that when the SS man passes in front of Gutta, an angel's hand covers his eyes. In this heartfelt conversation, Gutta and I talk about the fleeting human connections that fostered determination, making survival a possibility, the death of her innocence, and why even in the darkest of hours, she cannot and will not hate.
I never hated them then. I didn't like them. I wouldn't want to have anything to do with them or anything. But no, I can't forgive them. I can't forget what they did. But I do not hate people. I don't hate them.
I'm Sarah Grimberg, and this is A Life of Greatness. Working as a podcast and radio producer, I have been fortunate enough to cross paths with many intriguing people who have had a profound impact on me. In this series, I share stories and experiences from the people who have brought inspiration to my life, and hopefully yours too. Gutta Goldstein is the author of There Will Be Tomorrow and Towards the Future, a memoir. At 89 years of age, I am left in awe at her resilient, life-affirming spirit. Gutta came to Melbourne, Australia after the Holocaust. That is where she met my grandma Susie and my grandpa David. It is truly an honour to share her miraculous story with you. In this episode, you will understand the true meaning of courage, survival, and grace. Tell us about life in Poland before the war.
Well, my father had a business.
What did he do?
He had a shop with the textiles, had something to do with textiles. And he married Esther, my stepmother, who is a kindergarten teacher. And she had her own kindergarten. In those days, it was something very new. So her and her sister had a kindergarten in where we lived. And when I had a little sister, she was very cute and gorgeous. And she was 4 years. She was not quite 5 when
yes.
war started, and I was 9. And I went to school and I loved it. I had a wonderful teacher and it was a wonderful time.
So take us back. What were you doing when you found out that the war had commenced?
It was a Friday morning and I remember that very well. And I was eating. We had breakfast. And my stepmother had a brother and not far, sort of the next corner. So she
yes.
went, I think, to visit them. She came back and she said, very agitated to my father, "You wouldn't believe that. They just declared war." And my father said that. My father said, oh, the war wouldn't last much longer. They didn't take it that day because the propaganda was that the Germans have got paper planes. And so they didn't believe that it's going to last very long. And then things started to happen. My father and his brothers came back from Warsaw and they were saying that the Germans weren't very nice and a lot of people were killed on the way because a lot of people were running away from whatever, from the bombing.
Mm.
And then straight away, there was shortage of bread for a start. And people had to stand in queues for hours. And the Germans suddenly, that's only was for the first week. And then the Germans occupied, 8 days later, the Germans occupied Lodz. And straight away, immediately, the laws against the Jews were immediately, they tried to implement them. So when you stood in the line for bread, he'd go all juice out from the line. And then there was, you weren't allowed to walk on the in the main street, which they immediately named after Hitler. And you weren't allowed to go to the park anymore because they had
a thing on it.
I loved the park. We loved it. And they sold that lovely ice cream in the park and everything in the summer, the holidays. And yes, and there was music in the park before the war. It was lovely. But no, we couldn't because it was, there was a placard, Jews and dogs are forbidden to enter. You weren't allowed to sit on benches, on public benches. And you had to give, if you had a radio, you have to give it in. There was straight away a lot of things going on. And
were you scared then?
I wasn't scared. I was just confused. I didn't know what, I knew something terrible was happening, but I wasn't aware. So we were still in our place and we were still in our home and we still had all our family. So,
and you were seven.
And I was nine.
Nine.
I was nine. And so I still, you know, we were still at home. So I was always a bit of an optimist, I think. But
yes.
I just sort of thought, oh, well, that's going to pass. The grown-ups are going to be, you know, sort of normal again because they were the ones that, and suddenly they were, my father got some potatoes from somewhere, and they put all the potatoes under the beds, and people preparing this and they're preparing that and preparing food, and it was bedlam at home in a way.
For you, you love school, and it was like one of the most.
It was
the best time for you. You said to me, and you just love learning.
Yes,
and you write a beautiful passage in your book, There Will Be Tomorrow. You write, we arrived at school on the first day of term to find our teacher extremely sad with tears in her eyes. It was a school rule to stand when a teacher entered a classroom, but this time she bid us sit down and solemnly try to convey to her class of nine-year-olds the meaning and dangers of war and occupation and what might await us. She told us that she and her husband of a few weeks were going away, that we must be brave and good children because very bad times were ahead. Tears were falling from her eyes and her voice was gentle. We sat wide-eyed and listened, stock still. We felt the seriousness of what she was trying to convey. I cannot remember every word she said, but I can still feel the atmosphere of sadness and apprehension that prevailed that day in our classroom. At her most pessimistic, she could not have imagined what fate awaited us, her grade three pupils. We all said goodbye to her with her departure and the closure shortly afterwards of our school and the exclusion of Jewish children from all learning institutions. The sun set on my school days. Afterwards, schooling for Jewish children was forbidden. That's such
yes.
a sad day
it
for you.
It was very, very sad. It was terribly, terribly sad. We never saw her again. And I don't think she survived. It was terribly, terribly sad. But it didn't sink at the time. We sort of thought it's going to end. It's
yes.
not going to last. Because things were still kind of, I wouldn't say normal, but you were at home, you were in your country, you had your parents and they looked after you and you didn't have to worry about things, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, even the food, that they worried about it
yes.
and you didn't get hungry.
It was that innocence of being a child.
A child, exactly. You didn't, we still played, you know?
Yes.
I had
did you play?
We had games.
Mm.
Children played, you know,
yes.
and we read and we told and we sang and we... We were happy still. It was just that the atmosphere with the grown-ups was very sad and you couldn't be silly with them because they didn't have to, you know,
yes.
they had other things on their mind, I would say.
And Jews were no longer allowed to live in the main city. They were moved to a ghetto.
Yes, they had to move. And eventually an aunt, my father's sister, found a little place, and she offered to share it. So we shared it, and there were six people, the four of us, my aunt who was a widow and her daughter. It was a room, a small room, and with an annex. There were no facilities at all. There was no bathroom. There was no running water. There was no electricity. There was just nothing.
You were in that camp for a while, and 2 years after being in there, your dad got very ill.
Yes.
What was he ill with?
They said that he had pneumonia. And also I think he had tuberculosis by then. And the living conditions were terrible when he was sick. It was April. It was again spring. And because these places were very dilapidated, the snow was melting on the top of the roof and dripping.
And you write about that in your book, There Will Be Tomorrow. The children were awakened by moans and they listened helplessly to their father's anguish. He called for help. It was difficult and painful for him to breathe. He called for his mother. He needed her, but she was so far away. She was in Palestine. She lived there. I often wonder if she heard her son's desperate calling in his hour of need. In desperation, gasping for breath, he sent the elder of his children for help to his sister, who lived on the first floor of the front building across the courtyard. In the dead of night, the child, alone and frightened, she was always frightened of the dark, crossed the deserted courtyard on her sad mission. Shining brightly high, so high in the dark blue sky, was a full moon. This silent witness illuminating the silent dark courtyard accompanied her. Later in the morning, with the help of some neighbours, their father was moved and settled into Aunt's bed. The bed stood alongside a wall. When the children were brought in, he indicated for them to come closer. Holding hands, the two children approached the bed and stood there very quietly and very still. He did not speak, but his beautiful dark eyes and the sadness in them burnt a memory into the minds of those children. He looked at them long and deeply, then turned his head to the wall, and he was no more. My father, Judah Koppel, passed away at the age of 37 in the Lodz ghetto in Poland on the 8th day of Passover, the 19th of April, 1941. So you yes. and your sister were,
yes, were orphaned.
Orphaned.
Yes, because So he stayed with my aunt, and she looked after us.
She was like an angel, your aunt.
She was wonderful. She was a widow, as I said, and she was wonderful. And we stayed with her for a little bit, not terribly, terribly long.
Were you scared? Were you scared after your dad died? How old were you then?
12. And I wasn't scared, but I was sad. I don't think I was scared, but I was wondering, you know, I felt displaced. I didn't belong anywhere, you know. I didn't know that I should be scared, but I felt displaced and, you know, I had to behave myself my aunt was very nice to us, really. But that's how it was. And then they went to work and they started a factory already then.
Yeah.
And grown-ups went to work. But I still felt a little bit secure because she was looking after. There was a grown-up person that
you
took
trusted.
Charge.
Yes.
And you weren't sort of completely dislodged.
Yes. And how would your sister and you talk about what was going on?
Would you believe we didn't? I was thinking about it the other day. No, we were sort of...
What did you talk about?
We didn't. We didn't. We played.
Aww.
We played, and I, who was an avid reader, I loved reading. My mother encouraged it. My stepmother encouraged it. And I loved reading. And my stepmother, at a time when we were in bed, she used to get us books from people she knew who brought their private children's libraries to the ghetto, and then they lend it out to people. And I used to devour those books. And I remember there was a very, very sad story that I read, and I read it to my sister because she couldn't read yet. She was only five.
Yeah.
And school in Poland started at seven. So I read it to her, and I remember I cried my heart out for those children in this book. It had something to do about children that were before the war, that were very poor and lived in an attic. And there were five of them, and there were one older girl that looked after them because they lost their parents and they were orphans and they didn't have anybody. And I didn't consciously identify with it, but I was so sorry for those children.
Isn't
and for
amazing?
This what was going on, what was going on. And I still remember the title. It was called The Room in the Attic. And it was very sad. I just identified and I cried. I remember I cried when I read it.
Yeah. Did you cry a lot?
No, I didn't. I used to cry a lot when I was, before the war. You know, I remember when my father and my stepmother, and they were going out and we were by ourselves. And those days there weren't any babysitters.
Yes.
It was and we were going to bed anyway. And I cried and I made a scene. I didn't want them to go, you know. But later, no, I just knew that you shouldn't. I didn't want to make a fuss. I just went along.
It's funny, isn't it? It's like you had to hold your emotions in.
Exactly. Mm. I remember that I was with the reading. It helped a lot. And it's like running away from it and going into something else.
Yeah.
And so that's what I did. We read a lot. And Rumkowski, that was the head of, decided that he's going to make a school camp for the children to stay there. And he they got a bit of extra food for
it. So you went there.
So he said that there is this thing, maybe we could go there. Also, it's a school camp for school children. But suddenly there were lots of people became orphans. So there were lots of orphans and they didn't know. So he sent them there. And so it became a huge orphanage, this place. And we were...
And you were there with your sister.
Was persuaded because he said that we'll be better off having a bit more food.
So you and your sister, Munya, got very sick with the measles.
We had measles, and we were frolicking around in the beds. There were seven children that got measles.
And so what happened
to you?
And Munya
was very lively and very, you know. And then they decided they had to let the authorities know, you know, everything was very, very official.
Yeah.
That there are measles in this. See, so it came back. We were already nearly okay that we have to go to the hospital with diseases. And so when we got there, they put us in a room. They got us undressed and they gave us a bath, and they put these light clothes like 90s. It was freezing in that room, but absolutely freezing. And we were sitting there for hours and hours and hours. I don't know if they didn't have any bed. I don't know why. And my little sister was getting, you know, strange. And I saw, because she was very lively and sweet.
Yeah. How old was she?
And she was quite five. She was not quite seven. And suddenly she was very quiet and she was just sitting there and we were looking at what happened. And then suddenly she said she didn't feel very good. And by the time they got her, she had very, very high temperature, and they took her away. And that's when I got frightened. I went with the other children to one room, to the dormitory, so in a ward, and she was taken separately, and I didn't know where they took her. And that's when I sort of felt there are no grown-ups, there is nobody, it's just me and her, and I've got to look
the
after
first
her
time
because I'm
were
the
really
big sister
scared.
And she's little. So I was 12 and she was not quite seven, and I just anyhow eventually, by the time they settled us, I think it was evening. And then the next day, somebody told me that she was in a separate room. And I went out of my bed and I went to see her. And when I saw her, oh my God, she was crying. They heard her cry at night. And she was crying. And she was in terrible pain because there was no anesthetic or anything, and they took the lumbar fluid from her spine without anesthetic. And she was only little, and there was nobody that cared really. And I went and she says, could you go get the nurse? And I went and got the nurse, and that nurse was horrible. Yeah. And she said, she's been like that all night, and she's been crying all night, and I'll go and see her. And then I went back to tell her that the nurse doesn't want to come. And this is something I think, the look in her eyes, I will never forget as long as I live. I still can't. And such a resignation. And she says, all right, go. And I went. I should have stayed, of course, but I didn't. I don't know. And then it was a Jewish holiday of Shavuot. They were telling us. And I went back to my bed, and the children that were with us asked how she was, and that's what I told them. And then suddenly there was a nurse that came, and she was saying, oh, we have to close the windows, put the blinds down. And we didn't know why. And then eventually when they opened it, I still managed to see there was a doctor and a nurse that were going somewhere. And there was one boy who seemed to be smarter. He was older than us. And he said, oh, he heard that they're going to do an autopsy. I didn't know what an autopsy was. But what also I will never forget, that they were laughing. There were two nurses and a doctor, and they were going to do that on my sister. I didn't know that. Anyhow, I went to have a look again how she is. And there was an empty bed with all the sheets still on the floor, and she was gone. And that was that. And that was just absolutely awful. Awful is not a word. I never got over it, really. I really think I never got over it.
Yeah.
And that was it. Yeah. Unfortunately, there isn't even a grave. So then we were staying there for another little bit, and then we went back. And I remember that Carmela was talking to me, and she was talking and talking. But nobody sort of, I don't know how people were different. Whether it was respect or whatever, nobody came to talk to you about it.
Yeah.
Nobody came to say, how are you about your sister? It was not talked about.
So you just held inside.
And I was just there. And I remember today when I think about it, yeah, I think I was depressed.
Yeah.
I remember sitting just there and staring and being very scared and not talking to anybody for days. I used to go and eat, and I used to do this, but because I didn't
there was,
play.
There was no adult there anymore. Like you didn't have your sister, and there was no adult that was properly taking care of you.
And I didn't talk about it for years. Until I wrote that book, I never talked about it. My children didn't. I didn't even. Sometimes I used to say I had a sister, but I never. It's a hard memory. And every time, you know, I already had children, everything. I always, whenever I thought of her, I had this lump in my throat, like now. But and once I wrote it all down, I stopped crying about it.
Yeah.
It was amazing, but I stopped crying about it. But I still think, my goodness, she was such a wonderful little person. She was a very beautiful child and very happy. And she sang, we both sang very nicely, and she was so nice. And so sweet, and she suffered. If she, you know, if she just died, I think I wouldn't. But the way she died, it was just so awfully painful.
Shocking.
Yeah. There was a boy in the ghetto, and when I went to visit, there was a time we weren't allowed to go visiting from the camp walking because there were no transport. So I went to visit my aunt. And my aunt, of course, wasn't home because everybody was working. There was hardly, during the day, the ghetto was empty because everybody was in factories. And this boy came out. And he came out and he said, it was so nice, you know, he was the only one. And he said, I heard that Munya died already. And this already was such a poignant sort of...
Yes.
Yeah. So I said, yeah, that was it. The children talked like that, you know. We were,
so he tried to comfort you.
Yes. And the children knew about death and knew about hunger and they knew about everything
they
that
had
was
to
going
grow
on.
Up so fast.
Yes. And yet there were children in
spirit.
That was so nice of him. I remember when he said that. But it was very it was moving for me. But when he said already, it was a very telling word.
And then one of the worst times came when the train came for Auschwitz. What happened then?
When we all got on the train, there was this click, this loud click of the doors, you know, metal on metal closing. And that was it. It was dark. And all there was a tiny window somewhere up on top of one of the walls. There was no air. There was nothing. And we just sat there. And I remember my aunt, who was such an optimist, or at least she was trying to give us courage and hope. And I remember her daughter had temperature. She didn't feel so good. And she says, oh, well, you know, you'll be all right. Once we get there, they wouldn't make us work straight away the first day. And you'll be all right, you know.
Isn't it amazing, though, that during the worst of worst times, people can still have that courage and hope and try and pass that on to other people?
Yes, but you have to. If you don't have that, you don't have anything. You just give up. You don't have hope.
Do you think having that hope is what got you through?
Yes. My soul, my mind, my being was still intact. I never thought that I want, it's amazing, but when I think about it, I never thought that I was going, that I won't see the end of the war. I always said, when the war ends, and I was thinking of food, when the war ends, what are we going to eat, and what are we going to eat, and what are we going to eat? That was more or less in Auschwitz, that was the topic, nothing else. We were on a train and my aunt was trying to keep us
happy, you know, to happy, an extent.
You know, and eventually it stopped. And when we got off the train, it was hell. And that was when we got into hell. And the minute you were out of the wagon, there was immediately put you in a line and you had to start walking. And we were walking and we didn't know where we were yet. And suddenly they said, women separate and men separate, to separate. And my cousin, who was the boy, Carmela's brother, he was taken.
Was he by himself?
He was by himself.
How old was he?
He was 2 years older than me, so he would have been, at the time I was 14, that was 1944.
Yeah, so he was 16.
See, he was 16, yes. And he was all by himself. And so the four of us were just beside ourselves. We didn't know what was happening. And then we were still walking. And we walked and we walked and we walked. And suddenly we got to this place. We stopped in a line, and there was this huge, enormous man. He looked enormous. He was tall and wide, and he had this SS officer's hat and boots and breeches inside with a real German and a belt. When we got nearer, we saw the buckle had a death head, a skeleton head on it. And he was just standing there with one hand on his hip, and with the other one, he was moving the other wrist, and he was going left, right, left, right. And he was selecting people that way.
Did you understand what the left and what the right meant?
No, we didn't know, because we were just watching from far. And that was, at the time we didn't know, but that was the man called Mengele. And he was doing a medical experiment. He was actually a doctor, would you believe?
Yeah, shocking experiments.
Would you believe? He was doing, yes, and he was looking for twins. If they were a twin, he already got you separately. And my aunt, I was in the middle, because my aunt somehow must have felt that things were pretty awful. We were all frightened. It was confusion. And I was in the middle, and I was next to Inka, and Inka was next to her mother, and Carmela was next to me. And suddenly, they were all worried that he'll take me, because I was very short, you know, and very, you know, I didn't look my age. And so they were worried. And my aunt sort of looked at him, and suddenly he says, left, to my aunt. And she looked very, very confused, and she stopped. She didn't move when he said to. And once again, he just screamed, and he said, left. And then she went, and she was sort of, you could see. And then she was, I think the resignation was just sort of, and she went, and there was a group of other women on the other side, because we were the woman. And then he told us to move, and the next people were just behind us. So, and my aunt was just looking at us, we were looking at her, and that was that. And then never saw her again.
What would you think about when you were in the camp?
First of all, you thought about food, and you saw and about that you wouldn't get hurt, that they wouldn't hit you. That was, you know, survival. That you just didn't do. The best thing at camp was to be invisible.
But you would daydream quite a bit.
But then that was when we were sitting outside, yes. Sitting one, and I was daydreaming. I was daydreaming all the time when I could.
It was probably the only, I suppose, one time where being in the present is not a thing that you want. So
no.
Being in the future or the past is where the beauty actually lies. What would you think about?
Well, I was actually going home, always in my head.
Yeah.
I was thinking, I knew my father was dead, and I knew, you know, everybody was, most uncles and aunts and everybody. But I pretended they were all alive, and I pretended that even my mother was alive, and I pretended to be buried in my house where my mother still, you know, lived. And that's why I remember it all, because I went through it over it and over it. That's where I went. And I went to school, and I saw my teacher, and I went through the classes that we were.
You had happiness there.
And I tried to not to be there. I couldn't. And then
happiness was in your mind.
Yes. I needed it. I didn't know what else to do, because there was no future in what I was doing. I don't know if I understood that, but that was my instinct. I did need to do it. I need to run away from there, and I didn't know how. Most probably this was the only way I knew how.
In your mind.
And so my memories kept me going.
Was there kindness in the camps?
Well, with each other.
Yes, and what kind of kindness
with
did you
each
find?
Other, we looked at. If it is true that if you were on your own, it didn't last very long. It was very scary, and but when you were together, you sort of knew somebody yeah. cared. So yes, we sat there and we knew some people from the ghetto. So sometimes we managed very quietly to sort of say something, and the going thing was hold on. That's what
hold on.
In Polish, yes, it was, but you had to whisper it because you couldn't, and you couldn't move your mouth.
But you would whisper.
But you would whisper when you passed. If you passed somebody, if you whispered, and you say, "Hold on," you know, that was the. So it was something that you.
It was so beautiful.
You had to do something. You did have to. You went. You see, it was, in a way, I was just thinking always. It was them, and I don't know if everybody felt like I do. I don't know.
Yes.
Because we didn't talk about how we felt. We knew what was going on, so there was no need to talk about it. But I always thought, I'm innocent. I didn't do anything, you know. I didn't think like that, but I thought, they're the bad ones. They are the bad ones, and I'm different. And I had hope. I was always thinking when the war ends. And that was the kindness also. When I was with my friend, another two people from the ghetto that we knew, they always kept me in the middle because I was the short one. And when there was a selection, sometimes you had to go around a field or something. They walked so they wouldn't notice me sort of in the middle. But mainly, you had to stand there. In Auschwitz, it was naked, stark naked. You had to stand in fives, and the girls that were already much more. I was lucky. I wasn't developed at all.
Yes.
I was a child looking, and that's why they always worried about me because
I wasn't
supposed to be there in the first place. I suppose in the way that the Germans saw it. So one day there was a selection, and a few times we saw it, and there was a woman that we called the Angel of Death, and her name was Greise. She was a young woman. She was sadist. She was walking around with these big white gloves, and when I saw her at that selection, and there was also another man with her, another SS man. And I thought, oh, this is the end of my life. That I was thinking then. I thought, no, I don't think I'll make that because it was. And there was a line behind us and a line in front of us. When it came to my line, he looked at each one of us. And when he came to me in the middle, his head went down because I was short. And he said to me, "How old are you?" And I decided there before that, and I said it to the girls, I'm going to say I'm 17.
How old?
I was 13.
And if you were to not live, how old did you need to be for them to?
I needed to be 12,
yes.
not 2. But I was 14, but I looked a few years younger than I was. I was very young looking.
Yeah.
And I was, as I said, all the women were, you know, sort of developed and all this, and I wasn't. I was just flat. And he says, "How old are you?" And I said, nothing to lose. I said, 17. She would have hit me to death. But he just looked at me for a second, and then he took his hand and he just touched my chin. And he said, "But child, you are not 17. So I said, "No, I'm not." But I said, "I'm 14. And I was like very shy, you know. And I said, "I'm 14, but I want to stay with my sisters." And he says, "Who are your sisters?" And I pointed them out. And he says, "All right, so go back to the block." and he sent me back into the barrack. And he was must have been a nice man. Oh, this was the miracle.
April 16th, 1945 was the day that you were liberated.
Yes.
And that was...
That was another miracle.
Another miracle. There's a beautiful poem that you actually wrote in your book that I would love you to read.
It's called Liberation. Exultant, I'm running blindly through unfamiliar streets. My jailers have fled. I'm a bird uncaged, rejoicing in my freedom. My spirit is soaring. My wings unfold. I'm assailed by overwhelming emotions. I am. Euphoria lifts me off the ground. I float, I leap, I fly. My soul is singing, a song long lost in sadness and sorrow, bursts from the depths of my being. Yet not a sound comes forth. Ecstatic, I run faster and faster to the rhythm of my soundless singing. Frenzied, I run, propelled towards the welcome sound of approaching tanks, with hearts pounding and heads spinning. What exhilaration, what joy, there will be tomorrow. It was April 16, 1945. Bless the Americans. We were liberated. We were free. I was 15 years old.
Wow. How did you feel?
I felt fantastic. I think, I don't even know where my strengths come to the right. I felt so elated, but it was just so wonderful that you felt there was nobody watching you. You could go out, you could go in, you could go to the toilet, you could do things that you couldn't, that you weren't able to for years. It was just wonderful, just wonderful. Yes.
When you look back at your life now, why do you think you survived when so many perished?
That was my question and still is, actually.
Yeah.
That is my question. I really don't know. I think it was destiny and it was meant to be. And it was miracles. And that's all. I mean, I have no answers. I don't know whether there was anybody. Also, my cousin said to me, she said, whenever you passed a German or a German passed you, an angel held his eyes shut. And that's why you survived. That's what she's telling me. It was miraculous. And I think I was destined somehow. But I remember that was the first thought after liberation when I calmed down a bit and suddenly realized what's going to happen next and stuff. And then I was thinking, why did I survive? When everybody's dead, what you know, it's very confronting, I think, to suddenly be a survivor of such a massacre in the millions, and you have to somehow believe in things, and you have to think that there must have been a good reason why I survived.
Yes.
Something is expected of me. I don't know what, but there must be. Otherwise, what sense does it make?
Of course. How do you look at life now, having gone through the Holocaust?
I appreciate it. I find that every day is a miracle, that every day is a gift.
Do you appreciate things more now?
Very much. Always. Always. And everything. If I can sleep in the morning and I don't wake up at 4 o'clock and I, you know, and my warm bed and a hot shower and little things, or a piece of soap.
Yes.
When I think about it, I still do, you know, I seem
very
lucky. And also that I came to Australia, that was another lucky thing. I mean, that was a miracle, the way, because you couldn't go anywhere, and we put our names on many, many lists of countries that didn't take people. And Australia somehow came good, and we got here. And I think Australia was very good to us. And I do appreciate every little bit of it.
Do you harbour hatred still for the people that hurt you?
No. I never hated them then. I didn't like them. I just didn't like them, and I didn't think they were nice and right. I thought they were some monsters. But I was separate from them somehow, like I told you before. I was nicer than them. I sort of felt I'm not like that, and they're different, and they're not nice. So I had nothing to do. I wouldn't want to have anything to do with them or anything. But no, I can't forgive them. I can't forget what they did. But I do not hate people. I don't hate them. Don't waste my time on it.
Because, you know, when someone harbours so much hatred, they're just hurting themselves. And the fact that you went through the most shocking atrocities and you can sit here with me now and say that you do not hate these people is like letting yourself free.
I don't hate them.
Did you pray in the camps, and do you pray now?
Yes. When I was in Auschwitz, I must say, I tried to make a bargain with him. And I remember I did that. And I said, when they took my auntie away, I said, please let her come back. Please let her come back. I'll be such, it's so good. And I'll do all, you know, the things that, you know, I'll be good. But, it didn't happen. But that's another story. Yes. But yes, I rather talk to him. I don't officially do prayers.
No, but you speak to.
Yes. I ask him for things sometimes. I'm sort of very familiar, on familiar terms, so to speak.
What are you most grateful for?
I am most grateful for my life now, that I came to Australia, that I had a wonderful husband. I fell in love, and we both were in love. He was also a Holocaust survivor. He also had a horrendous time, and he lost his people, and we have a wonderful family, and that we could have a family that we still continue.
What is a life of greatness to you?
I would say someone that saved somebody's life would be a life of greatness to me. And somebody that did something nice for other people. My aunt was great. That was a life of greatness. So she, you know, she was selfless. Yes, that's what I think.
Gutta Goldstein, thank you so much. Your words have touched thousands of people, and you coming here today to tell this story, I am so unbelievably grateful for. Thank you for sharing that with us.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak and to tell my story.
If you've enjoyed this episode, then I'd love you to join my community on Instagram at Sarah Grimberg, where we post videos and behind-the-scenes footage of each recording. You can also join my private Facebook group, Live Life Greatly, where we discuss the content in this episode and many more, as well as give advice and tips on how to live a life of love and meaning. To purchase my ebook, Finding Greatness, head to sarahgrimberg.com. And if you love what you heard, then we'd love you to hit subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favourite podcast app and leave a 5-star review. It will help us share this wisdom with others. A Life of Greatness's executive producer is me, Sarah Grimberg. Audio producers Matt Nikolic and Darcy Thompson. Special thanks to Grant Tothill for bringing this dream to life. For more episodes, search A Life of Greatness podcast, download the new listener app now, and listen for free. listener.